Go ahead, lounge around in bed with a good magazine. We'll even read it to you. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. Live. On Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Actually, wait. Turn up the click a little bit more on my
Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network. Ben Annis, Pierre Joyce, Craig Battle. So much to get to in the next couple of hours. Alex Rodriguez playing his final game in pinstripes, we assume. Final game ever in Major League Baseball. Penny Oleksiak becoming now a household name in this country, emerging on the scene in a big way. First week at the Olympic Games, and our under 20 Canadian hockey team not doing so well at the Ivan Hlinka Memorial Tournament. Also, Masai Ujiri potentially on the verge of a contract extension with the Toronto Raptors. But, gents, let's start with the Blue Jays, who lost Game 1 of their three-game set at Rogers Centre against the Houston Astros after taking 2 of 3 from the Rays. Pretty decent road trip previous to that, taking 4 of those 7 games through Houston and Kansas City against the defending champs. We're into now round number 2 of this 6-man rotation. The return's very meh on Francisco Liriano first couple of times through the rotation. And the offense in a bit of a slump here in the month of August. Concern? Learning anything new, Gare? What's your initial reaction to the 6-man rotation here now that you've got a little brief opportunity to see how it works?
Well, when Liriano was done, when the deal was done, you know, I felt like you're trading for something that someone was rather than is. And that never works out. And, you know, if you took a look at Liriano from 2 or 3 seasons ago versus the guy that was on the mound last night, they don't look like the same creature. And, you know, I worry about that. I don't know that the way this is playing out right now, that it's going to be sustainable. Like, I think maybe – I can't say that Liriano will be on a short leash or anything like that, but if there's 2 more dodgy starts, then, boy, I think you have to reevaluate.
And then what happens, Craig? Because the whole idea behind this 6-man rotation is to make sure Aaron Sanchez remains in the rotation, which, one, apparently he wants – just for his long-term health, he believes he can be healthier in the rotation than he can throwing every day, or, you know, 2 out of 3 days coming out of the bullpen and throwing it up 97, 99 on any given day. But two, it's to make sure that Aaron Sanchez is still in the rotation come playoff time. The idea, though, being you're in the playoffs and you've made the playoffs, and it's a dicey proposition right now. The Jays half game back of the Baltimore Orioles for first in the American League East in that wild card spot, but that's, you're guaranteed 1 game if you finish there. How the next couple of weeks play out as far as wins and losses affect what this team does when it comes to this 6-man rotation?
Well, I think what it does is it means that you have to make one of the hard decisions that they managed to avoid making in the first place. Either move Aaron Sanchez to the bullpen or just sort of run him out every, you know, 5 days like they'd sort of, like he would want and like half the team really wants. If Liriano doesn't turn back into a serviceable pitcher, then you've got a situation where you can't run out that 6-man rotation. You can't rest Aaron Sanchez, and you're in that sort of situation again where he's pitching, you know, in the mid-200s style innings, right? Like, I think that it was sort of set up as a stopgap. Like, we don't want to sort of move him to the bullpen because that's unpopular. We don't want to run him out every 5 days. But then if Liriano doesn't sort of work out into sort of even a mediocre kind of starter, if he's a guy that gets shelled every game and doesn't even give your team a chance to win, then you're in a lot of trouble. That's it. I don't know that he's completely lost yet. Like, he looked okay in that first start.
He has his moments, right?
He certainly does, right? Like, he's a guy with a pedigree, so he could, you know... I don't expect him to be as bad as he was on Friday night every game heading forward. Do you, Gare?
I see him having moments in a game.
Yeah.
The problem is that he's not having games.
Right.
Right? You know, Look, all you're wanting is for him to be a replacement level pitcher, right? You just need someone to buy spots and eat innings. You know, is he a replacement for Drew Hutchison even at that level?
I was going to ask the same question. If that was your goal, because we talked all season long, it's like, oh, it's really nice to have like a, you know, bona fide six starter just waiting down there in Buffalo, you know, for you to pull up. I mean, they did on occasion. So, yeah, like what was the big deal? Why did you need to get Liriano if that's what you were going for? If you just wanted a six starter, and then that would allow you to, you know, pick Drew Hutchison spots and try to avoid him playing in certain situations. So it does seem like a situation that they could have avoided adding all that salary on. And we've talked in the past about how this is great. You know, they're a team now that can rent a guy and also get a couple of prospects like they did from the Pirates. But how much better is having a you know, so-so Liriano than a what we know of with Drew Hutchison?
The hand-wringing that surrounded Drew Hutchison was that, okay, this is a guy who had an ERA over 5 a year ago, and he's your replacement for Aaron Sanchez. So Aaron Sanchez leaves the rotation. He goes to the bullpen where you assume he'll be great once again, because why not? He throws hard, and he's shown the ability to transfer those skills to shorter stints. But Drew Hutchison, okay, maybe he doesn't have an ERA over 5, but he's not exactly a front-of-the-rotation guy, so that's a massive downgrade in the rotation. We can't quite say that yet, because Aaron Sanchez is still in the rotation as far as a downgrade from him to Liriano. But at some point here down the stretch, because six-man rotation alone doesn't get the Blue Jays to a situation they're comfortable in seeing Aaron Sanchez at the end of the season when it comes to innings. And I know innings are not the be-all, end-all when we're talking about measuring workload either. But if at some point you are removing Aaron Sanchez for a start or two a month, and it is, we're back to a five-man rotation, and Liriano's in there, and he's anything close to the first couple of starts we've seen from him, Gear, it's not exactly, right, like that is the huge downgrade you thought might be possible if Sanchez went to the bullpen and Drew Hutchison was the Drew Hutchison of 2015.
Well, yeah, when I say replacement level, I'm not talking about a replacement for Sanchez in the rotation. I'm just talking about like a major league median pitcher, you know,
yeah,
or even someone on the low end. And, you know, look, everyone will take a look at Sanchez through August 1 and say, okay, so the last 2 months of his season are going to be entirely consistent with that. You know what? I mean, more likely than not, there was going to be a little fall to earth for Sanchez as well. You know, that you can't expect him to win, you know, to go 7-1 the rest of the way either, right? Like that's not realistic. So, I mean, in the big picture, I get where the Jays are coming from. I don't entirely disagree with the idea of like saving some innings on and some wear and tear on Sanchez's arm. But you know what? It's been done before. I know that I was just looking like at Jimmy Key's numbers, oh, yeah, you know, and to go from 62 innings one season to like 212 and 232 and 262 the next three, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess he had one minor league season where he pitched over 180 innings. But you know, I think that Sanchez could have handled more of a workload. And if they abandon this in September, I don't think there's any big cost. And if they're going to roll the dice on Sanchez being able to throw more in the last month of the season, then I don't think it's been a high cost for this experiment.
But when they abandon it, are they more likely to just move Sanchez to the bullpen like they planned originally? Or are they going to just sort of say, okay, we've given you a little bit more rest, we've limited those innings, now we're just going to run you out as a regular starter every 5 days and do something else with Francisco Liriano?
It seems like a situation where, as long as the performance is there, from all the tea leaves that I'm reading, from all the information we're getting, from all the veiled comments that are coming from Aaron Sanchez himself, when he spoke for the first time after that Monday non-waiver trade deadline where Mark Shapiro, Ross Atkins did their media blitz talking about him. Okay, finally, we can say definitively he's going to the bullpen because we acquired a starter in Francisco Liriano who struck out more than 200 a year ago. And I know he's having a down year, we slot him in there. We're paying for upside here. And then just a couple of days later, after meeting with Sanchez, Ross Atkins flew in the chopper, landed in center field at Minute Maid Park, and then had the long conversation with Aaron Sanchez. That it seemed like that conversation, while it was, yeah, it was two-way to a degree, it was very one-way in that it was Aaron Sanchez saying, I've been the good soldier here. I've told you that I'll do whatever you tell me to do as long as you think it's in the best interest of this team winning games. But here's the deal. We're also talking about my long-term health. And it's not just a, hey, what situation gets this team to 95-plus wins and into the postseason? It's also my potential future earnings. And honestly, I think Aaron Sanchez believes that it's a better deal for him to have a controlled environment in which he pitches, knows when he's pitching, which means he's in the rotation. I think that that's the big impetus for this. And we can talk all we want about where he's more suited or I don't even know if that's a conversation anymore because the guy's in the Cy Young conversation. So there's not really much pushback you can have for Aaron Sanchez is better suited in the bullpen. But the only conversation I think we're talking about here when it comes to Aaron Sanchez is he believes he's healthier in the rotation. And all things being equal, I think that's where he is the rest of the season unless there's some massive drop in production, drop in velocity, something that we haven't seen yet this season. I think save for that, he's in the rotation the rest of the season.
Well, this conversation about him going to the bullpen, I mean, I've always thought it's him going to the bullpen to watch the rest of the season play out.
Yeah.
You know, that he wouldn't be a principal, one of the keys in the bullpen. You know, it's just like a place where it's a safe haven. Right.
Well, you want to take Jason Grilley out of that role right now? No. Either because he's been really good.
No, that's it entirely. Like it's just it's like a savings account is the way that the Jays would look at it, I think. I agree. I'd rather see him in the rotation in this spotted slot right now. But again, I honestly think it's going to turn around. I don't, unless Liriano shows something that we haven't seen, I don't know that it's sustainable.
To me, the situation is kind of sort of regrettable in a sort of larger sense in the way that it didn't have to be like this. It didn't have to be this massive conversation. They could have started out the season from an organizational standpoint saying, you know what, we know that Aaron Sanchez hasn't pitched a ton of innings at the major league level, and we're going to watch that, and we're going to make sure that we're keeping an eye on him. But right now, he's a starter because he's a huge talent, and he helps our team win. Instead, they made that hard and fast. Oh, no,
yeah.
Definitely, we will be doing this. Don't worry about it. And then now you've got this situation where the team has to go back on its word and it has to sort of have these press conferences to say, okay, well, we're not doing exactly what we said. And then that makes it them look like they're floundering, like they don't have a plan, like they were just saying some words and hoping that it all worked out, right? Like that to me doesn't really build sort of faith in your decision-making or your planning.
Yeah, it seems like they're chasing their tail a little bit when it comes
at this point, for sure,
how this is perceived. And does that matter necessarily? Maybe it only matters to us, but yeah, it doesn't look like they know exactly what is going on, and maybe there's a better plan right now. Before we move on back to the rotation, one last point. So we mentioned the six-man rotation, early returns not great, ERA is a little inflated when the starters are on 5 days rest as opposed to 4 days, but we're talking about one turn through the rotation, and that can, you know, a bad start or two can throw all those numbers out of whack because we've seen some good starts in there as well. I mean, and Jay Happ now all of a sudden is in the Cy Young conversation as well, leading the major leagues in wins. Not that that's a statistic we're all pointing to as being the reason you win a Cy Young in 2016. But all season long, we've talked about how this rotation has really outperformed expectations. It's late in the season. We have a large sample size when it comes to Marco Estrada, Jay Happ now, Aaron Sanchez, Marcus Stroman. We know he's been very up and down this season. But is there still like that lingering doubt about the ability for this rotation to be as good as it's been all season long? Or are we now all believers that Jay Happ is now just good and that Marco Estrada now, because he's shown the ability to get pop-ups, because that changeup is so good. We understand that, yeah, he is, despite the fact that he gave up 1,000 home runs in the National League last time he was there, he's made enough adjustments that he's just one of the best starters in Major League Baseball, and that Aaron Sanchez, as long as he's healthy, is one of the best starters in the American League as well. Is there still somewhere in the back of your mind where you think, yeah, maybe there is some regression that will take place in this rotation?
Well, I think J-Hap is not quite as good as his record. Mm-hmm. But when J-Hap was brought back, I was happy to see that, because I thought in his last year in Toronto that he was very solid. You know, Marco Estrada, I physically, that's a scare to me more than anything. Like, you know, and that goes right back to spring training. Right?
Yeah, missed his first start because of the back issue.
Yeah, and you know, it's a back, right?
Yeah.
Like, mm-hmm. I don't know how much you really shake those. So if it slides back a little, that would seem entirely possible. But I don't see it all falling down.
Yeah, and I think for me, it's more of a fear kind of thing. You know, like, you've got three players who are playing over expectations. You know, like, Marco Estrada was great last year, but a lot of people were wondering about that contract in the offseason, saying, well, that there's probably going to be a regression here, right? Just because he's never been this good. But he is good. He is, you know, barring any missed time through the back injury or breakdown through the back injury, mm-hmm. that he's been a good pitcher. He's had a couple of off nights just like anybody else does. His first outing in the six-man rotation, one of them. But, like, I believe in him as a pitcher. I believe in his stuff. That changeup is great. Like, we've seen those guys pitch well. It's just sort of that as a sports fan, you kind of feel that, like, well, you know, like, there should be regression, or, like potentially there will be, and that kind of just sits in the back of your head.
Yeah, because you're a sports fan in Toronto.
Exactly.
Although things are changing now with the success the Raptors have had, and the Blue Jays were in the playoffs and made it to an American League Championship Series last year, that maybe you don't believe the trapdoor is about to open.
Well, sure. I think that builds a little bit of emotional goodwill up, but there's only so many like season best or like sort of like personal best kind of performances that you sort of take, you know, with three of your starters having, you know, those career years. Like, one of them is like, oh, great, you know, Aaron Sanchez did well, but the other guys are sort of, they're even keel. But these guys are all playing so well, you feel like, well, would it be that surprising if one of them sort of started to fall off to career norms at this point? And it wouldn't be.
It's Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network, Ben Ennis, Gare Joyce, Craig Battle. So, yeah, the starting pitching hasn't been super spectacular over the last six starts, but really, you look at the problem, if there is a glaring one in August, because the record's not been horrible by any stretch of the imagination, Blue Jays have not taken off, the offense hasn't been what it's been the last couple of months. In August, we've seen a downtick, and they're a little banged up now, are the Blue Jays. Jose Bautista back on the disabled list now with a knee injury, apparently not going to need more than the 15 days, and I'm sure part of this as well is the Blue Jays are under very much a roster crunch with the six-man rotation, that they can't afford to have dead weight on that bench, guys that can't play, not on the disabled list. So he goes to the DL. Same situation with Kevin Pillar, who's there as well. So now Darryl Siciliani is playing against all comers, seemingly, or at least against righties for sure. Melvin Upton Jr. and his 290 whatever on base percentage is in the lineup every day. And yes, you've still got your big bats, Josh Donaldson, and Devin Travis is turning into one of the elite hitters in the American League, it seems like. Edwin Encarnacion right there as well, and Troy Tulowitzki, since coming off the disabled list, has been one of this team's most consistent hitters. But you got guys like Michael Saunders. You want to talk about coming back to earth, mm-hmm. despite hitting home run number 20 in game one of that series at Rogers Center against the Astros. A guy who's never done this in his career, especially the hitting of lefties. Is it, and we've seen this at times during the season as well, a lot of people were ready to jump off the bandwagon in April and May because this team wasn't hitting, and they thought, well, the almost 900 runs they scored in 2015, that's a mirage. It was an outlier, and you can't do that in back-to-back seasons. Well, they bounced back in a big way offensively. Is there a concern there offensively, Gare, especially considering the injuries the Blue Jays are dealing with right now?
I think there's a legitimate concern there. Although, remember, like they did that without Travis last year. And, you know, he's been a contributor. Like what you've lost in one place, you're making up a bit in another.
He won a couple of games by himself in the last week and a half.
Yeah, mm-hmm. He's and I mean he was the forgotten man last fall. But I think there is concern. You know, I just wonder when they say that Bautista is not going to need more than the 15 games. I'll believe it when I see it.
We've heard that before, haven't
yeah,
we?
Yeah, yeah. I have no faith in that whatsoever. But yeah, down the stretch, Saunders is again sort of returning to previously established values. You know, he might end the season. After having 19 homers in July, I guess he might end up with 22 at the rate he's going. And he was a cornerstone early and a lot less later on. It's not last year's team. It's not a 900 run team. It's going to be something else. They're going to have to win with a different mix as it goes forward.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah,
for me, yeah, Bautista and when he returns and what he returns like, because he was having like, you know, just in terms of OPS alone in August, he was a little bit better than he was in June and July when he was awful, right? Like, so if he can find his way back from both those injuries and sort of get into a sort of a regular rotation, sorry, not a regular rotation lineup, find himself in playing more often than not, and he's, you know, some semblance of the Jose Bautista that Toronto Blue Jays fans have come to know, then that really helps you. That gives you an emotional boost. It gives you a production boost. And then it allows you to push one of these guys who's not hitting into a sort of a more irregular role. And I think that's just sort of a big question mark hanging over the rest of the season for me is in terms of how many runs they can produce and can they produce regularly? Because we're seeing a lot of these nights where they get out good. They get 7 runs. The next night they show up and they don't score at all. And that wasn't a problem that last year's team had.
Jose Bautista is an interesting case because we talked preseason about the number written down on the napkin. I'm not sure if it was a napkin, but he gave the Blue Jays a number. It wasn't there. He said there was no negotiating. Here's the number. Would you like to sign up for this number or would you not? The Blue Jays said thanks, but no thanks. We'll play the season out. We'll get back to this, I guess, in the off season. Edwin Encarnacion, same thing. He said he wouldn't negotiate once the season started. And here we are in the middle of the season. One guy's stock has gone way up. The other guy's stock, I would say, safe to say, has plummeted a little bit when it comes to Jose Bautista. Now, there's still plenty of time left, right? Even when he gets back in a couple of weeks, you know, has a last month and a half and hits the cover off the ball and takes his fair share of walks. But I think one thing for sure, he's demonstrated that defense is going to be an issue for him, and he's limited his suitors to probably an American League team with the DH. I wonder what happens to him this offseason in Jose Bautista.
Well, I'm not sure if it was Shapiro or Atkins, but one of them used that napkin to mop up some spilled coffee.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. They didn't need to keep it.
No. You know, just looking at it, if you still take it as an article of faith that that Bautista is going to be back, step one. You know, the last 6 seasons, he'll have in 3 of those seasons, he'll have played less than 120 games. And if this is something more than 15 games, 3 of those seasons, he'll have played less than 100, right? You know, how going forward, the market for Bautista, I don't think is, you would describe it as soft, but it's softer than it was.
Yeah, it's not like he's improved his ability to make close to his $100 million this season. Now, I understand the free agent market is, you talk about soft, there's not a lot out there. It's going to be a seller's market, but you wonder. I mean, everybody's seeing what we're seeing in right field, and it's not that he's a statue out there, but the arm is now a non-factor. It's not a thing. It's not even average, his arm, anymore. And it's a shame. And maybe it comes down to just one throw trying to gun out Delman Young at first base because he was upset at being thrown at by the Baltimore Orioles. But yeah, he's a first base DH type. And maybe it affects Blue Jays' ability to retain him in the offseason, which maybe isn't the worst thing in the world.
No, but maybe it winds up being that he doesn't cost quite as much. Well, obviously, he's not going to cost quite as much. We're talking about the market for him going down. But maybe what this means is because I think a lot of us have gone through this season sort of thinking like, well, Edwin and Jose are both going to be gone. We don't have the money for these guys. They're going to get suitors from the Red Sox who are losing David Ortiz, and they're definitely looking for a DH. There's always the Yankees with their big spending. There's a bunch of big spending teams. And then when it was sort of looking like he could have gone to the NL and been a right fielder, this sets up a situation where, to me, Jose Bautista is more likely to finish his career as a Toronto Blue Jay, just because it's now a conversation. Before the season, Jose Bautista was riding a wave straight off the bat flip towards legendary status. You know, like, you're going to have to pay to keep me because of what I've done for this city and my track record as a hitter and a fielder and everything going into that. He was operating from a position of strength. Now he's not operating from the same position of strength. He's going to be more willing to talk. And, you know, if it's me and I'm in a situation, I'd prefer to finish my career the place that gave me the opportunity to become a major league superstar.
And it's interesting what a season like this can do to change not just perception, but the actual operation of this franchise. Because we've mm-hmm. seen an interview by Mark Shapiro, Ross Atkins this week, and quotes from them. I mean, Blue Jays lead the American League in attendance, and they're right up there with the Dodgers. I mean, the better attendance record than the Yankees, than the Red Sox, the number one in the American League,
mm-hmm.
one of the best in all of baseball. There's 40,000 plus on a Monday against the Tampa Bay Rays at Rogers Center, and this team's only been good for what, a year and a half now. Maybe a full calendar year, just slightly yep. over a full calendar year, that there is, at some point, you've got to react to that if you are ownership. And we've seen it already with the ability to take on $13-plus million of Francisco Liriano, which is very much not a certainty that he'll be producing at a high level. You would expect that to continue into the offseason, and maybe the dollars that were very much a question mark to be there preseason. Now with the season you've had as far as attention, as far as ratings, and as far as attendance, actually does affect your ability to retain Jose Bautista and Edwin Encarnacion this offseason.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's sort of one of the phenomenon that has been underplayed is the fact that the attendance numbers have been, like, that's a dynamic changer.
Mm-hmm.
Going forward, you'd hope that would translate into some wherewithal to do deals that maybe you weren't going to be able to do with 25,000 or less fans coming out. You know, I don't think I saw it coming that there would be 40,000
yeah,
on
crazy.
A regular
no.
and basis.
And even last year, that only started to happen late August.
In August, yeah. Well, in mid-August, probably.
Yeah.
But, you know, I guess when you've been standing in bread lines so long, waiting for something to bring home to the family, you know, that's where Toronto fans are. If they don't make the playoffs, if they're out in a wild card game this fall, you know, are there going to be 40,000 showing up early next season? I'm not really sure.
Yeah, I think if it was a much more fair weather fan base, we probably would have seen just with the beginning of the season kind of question marks that they were having. Why aren't they hitting? What's wrong with this bullpen? They weren't top of the table. You could have had people sort of semi bailing out and moving on, and then only picking back up now that they're sort of threatening for first again the last few weeks, right? But that didn't happen. You know, you try to get a ticket for mid-September right now, and you're, you know, in the nosebleeds if you can get it at all. You're
yeah.
you know, a single ticket by yourself in, you know, nowhere. So I feel like they've built up, as far as I'm concerned, a little bit of goodwill, just because especially you're going to have Donaldson, Tulowitzki, Russell Martin, Aaron Sanchez, Marcus Stroman, Roberto Osuna, like a lot of the core, even if Bautista and Encarnacion do wind up going and playing somewhere else next season, you've got a lot of the people that fans are coming to see and that fans have developed relationships with. So next season, I could see it. It would take, for me, a major rebuild. Like, we're shipping off the players that have value, and we're trying to get prospects back. for the fans to completely abandon for next season. So that's, I feel like that those fans are there and those ticket sales are there heading into next season. I think you can operate from a position of the attendance leader in the American League and with that extra financial capital that brings.
Those 40,000 plus that are showing up to every game will not have a chance to see Alex Rodriguez at Rogers Center anymore. He's played his final game in Toronto, his final game, I assume, in Major League Baseball. Certainly his final game with the New York Yankees, wrapped it up Friday night at home against the Tampa Bay Rays, had to dodge the weather a little bit. We'll talk about that and whether the Yankees maybe did him wrong in his final week in the majors. That's coming up next. Ben Ennis, Garrett Joyce, Craig Battle. It's Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
With a taste of what's on Sportsnet.ca right now, here's Evan Rosser.
When Rimsky-Korsakov wanted a piece of music to really move, he just wrote Presto on the score. The result? Easy. But how do you hit the top speed of the human body on an Olympic track, particularly when you're not built like a traditional elite-level sprinter? Head to sportsnet.ca right now to discover the physiological secret behind Canadian 100-meter medal hopeful Andre de Grasse's blazing speed. And while you're there, immerse yourself in our wall-to-wall coverage of the Rio Games. With daily viewing guides, nightly roundups, and in-depth features on everything from track cycling to javelin to decathlon, we'll make sure you don't miss a moment of the action.
Fans can find this story and more on Sportsnet.ca. Canada's home for sports news, analysis, videos, and features. Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. No medical exam or health questions will be asked. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
Wearing this uniform is so special to me. And these pinstripes are they're the best. We have a great future, and I'm still part of the organization, and I'll be watching. But tonight was about the fans, and to see a stadium packed like this, it's been a while and it's been a lot of fun. I put these fans through a lot and I've disappointed a lot of people, and it feels good.
All as expected, Alex Rodriguez standing ovation at Yankee Stadium in his final game in pinstripes, possibly, I think likely, his final game in Major League Baseball. Yankees beat the Rays 6-3 at the stadium Friday night. It is Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. Ben Ennis, Garrett Joyce, Craig Battle. Yeah, Alex Rodriguez done-ish. Going to remain with the Yankee organization. He's going to get paid a ton next season because he's still under contract for another year, but the production just not there, despite the fact that he had an RBI double in Friday's game. His final game in pinstripes finishes this season hitting 200 with a 247 on base and a 351 slugging percentage. Played one out at third base at Yankee Stadium as well in his final game. So we knew that this would be the final week for Alex Rodriguez. Had three games at Fenway Park in Boston. Only got into a couple of those games. It was a bit of an awkward situation the first game. Initially, Joe Girardi said he would play in all three of those games and then backed off that comment because he said, we're still trying to win games. And the Yankees, really, you look at the wild card standings, they're right there. They're hanging in there, despite the fact that they've sold off all these pieces. And naturally, there's always a pushback to things, right? If everybody believes one thing, you got your devil's advocates. It's amazing, Craig, now. I think there's a lot of people, either one, that feel sympathy for Alex Rodriguez, or two, feel that the Yankees have kind of done him wrong in his final week in the majors, despite maybe Friday's being the exception.
Yeah, I think that there's definitely that feeling. And to me, it's a weird situation that it seems, again, that they kind of created it themselves where they could have quietly let him play a little bit.
After a series opening loss last night to Houston,
towards the end of the season, they could have just sort of, you know, let it play out under the radar. Like, here's Alex Rodriguez not playing that well, but we've sold off a bunch of pieces. If we flail at the rest of the season here, then, you know what, it's okay. You know, like we made the moves. We're thinking towards the future. We've got Alex Rodriguez playing a little bit here and there. No big deal. But they made it such a massive deal. And then it seems like, okay, so if you're going to make him have like a retirement on X day, then you have to at least give him that, you know, like last night, not giving him the type of at bats or the type of you know, treatment. It kind of seemed like, you know, like whether he deserves it or not, whether you owe him anything, considering you've given him millions and millions of dollars, you allowed him to win that World Series with you, all that. Just sort of let it play out. Like let him stay on the field. Let him do what he needs to do. Play him those three games, and then move on. But I don't know. It seems like they kind of tried to have it both ways, and they, you know, we want to honor him, but we're not going to give him the kind of treatment that honor would normally have.
What's happened to loyalty and sentiment?
Oh,
couldn't we
true.
Just have like one last year analysis for old time's sake?
That's right. He should have been juicing here this final week as well, right? If he's going to go off into the sunset, who cares if he's suspended? I suppose he has to give that money back, but
yeah. That might have something to do with it. But it's I fully expect him to wash up someplace in the next
as a player.
Yeah, I do.
Wow.
You know, although, like, I was looking at it. I mean, we were talking earlier that Wade Boggs, you know, finishes his career in Tampa Bay. You know, it goes to Tampa Bay at 40. But the scary part in looking at it, Wade Boggs at 39, his OBA with the Yankees was .397. Right, like even at 41, he hit .301 with Tampa.
Right, you know, but not a lot of power, but yeah, he got on base. He was still a productive hitter.
He was still Wade Boggs. He did what Wade Boggs always did. Yeah, you know what? I can just smell this idea of bringing him in, and it, you know,
he's so close. He's four home runs away from 700.
Yeah. Right. I mean, is he as completely shot as Willie Mays was when he went to the Mets?
That's the gold standard of being shot, isn't it?
Absolutely, and that's the ultimate as far as trading for someone for what he was rather than what he is. But yeah, I could see it. I can see Rodriguez washing up somewhere else.
Right. And I mean, I don't necessarily feel bad for Alex Rodriguez in the situation, but I kind of feel, yeah, how could you, right? Like, he's had opportunities. He's, you know, he's played super well. He's dominant, you know, four home runs away from 700. He's had one of the best careers in baseball, but he's also had his moments of, you know, absolute, you know, career killing PR, you know, where he's got, you know, bad magazine covers. He's seeking out attention. And
oh, you think the one where he's kissing himself in the mirror was a bad idea?
It turned out in retrospect, maybe he shouldn't have done it. But no, like he certainly sought out all the attention he could possibly get, and he got a ton of it, and most of it wound up sort of backfiring on him. The PED suspensions.
None of it to his financial detriment, mind you.
Exactly. He's made what, $500 million more in career earnings. So he's done well. He's great. But I feel like, yeah, like if you sort of set it up as a hoopla for the fans, and then you're sort of quibbling with how much time he's actually going to get, that just sort of seems strange and overcomplicated. Even though you are, like you said, 3.5 games out of the wild card, very surprisingly, they won last night's game. They gave him 4 at bats. So yeah, they won 6-3. They're still doing well. They were doing well enough with him playing the limited role he is.
So. It was, I thought, going to be a very interesting week, considering he's having almost the identical season that Mark Teixeira is having. And Mark Teixeira has announced this season that this will be his final. He will retire at the end of the year. It's different from Mark Teixeira because he's not under contract past this season. Mm-hmm. So he's not going to be paid at the end of the year. But the Yankees could have released him as well. Could have said, thanks a lot. If it's all about winning games, thanks, but no thanks, Mark. We're moving on, and you can get a couple of games. He gets the rest of the season. Alex Rodriguez, you get 4 games. You get to go to Fenway, but you don't get to play. You'll be the bat off the bench that you've been for really the last month and a half or so. You get into maybe a game a week as a pinch hitter. And then we'll play on Friday. And it's also got a little bit of double talk as well. If it is, all it's about is winning games, and you believe your best chance to win games is without Alex Rodriguez in the lineup, then why even do Friday at all? Why play him at all in that game as well? If there's no sentimentality, if there's no send-off involved here, like that, It's clearly doublespeak by the Yankees.
Yeah, to what end? You know, it's hard to figure. I mean, at the end of the day, Rodriguez has been a major league pariah for a good number of years,
yeah.
And the only only refuge he had from that was Yankee Stadium and the Yankees organization. And you know what? It's great payback. Like at some level, it's great payback for you know, a guy who was who took on the league, you know, mm-hmm. Battled. Who fought his suspension. I mean, the Major League head office just must love him getting drilled out rather than going out with a farewell tour.
Yeah, I think a lot of Yankee fans as well, and certainly the New York City tabloids enjoyed this final week for Alex Rodriguez. What a first week it's been in Rio for our Canadian women, especially in the pool. It's amazing how quickly you can become a household name, and that's exactly what's happened to Penny Oleksiak. We'll head to Rio coming up next. Ben Ennis, Gear Joyce, Craig Battle. It's Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Do not settle. Demand. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. It's a magazine. You don't have to feel obligated to buy from your nephew's fundraiser. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live, free on your radio. Now. Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Hey there, Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network, Ben Ennis, Craig Battle, and Gare Joyce. Rio games rolling right along. First week is all about the pool. So many swimming events, so many medals given out in aquatics. Second week is generally about the running, and then, of course, the 100-meter final, in which we will determine the fastest man on Earth. But the first week, yeah, mentioned, it's the pool, and that usually means not a lot of success for the Canadians and Canadian women. It's been really bereft of some great results over the last couple of decades or so, except for this year. And we talk so much about how the Olympic Games, its events, its names, we think about once every 4 years. Well, Penny Oleksiak is not a name you've heard of at all, unless you're really, really into swimming in this country. And now all of a sudden, in a week and a half span, she's become the star emerging from this country, across the country, has four medals, a chance to pick up a fifth on the final day in the pool on Saturday. Gare, it's been unbelievable. She's 16. She's like 6'2". Her brother plays in the NHL. It's a great story, and it's, I think, without question, the story so far, these games for Canadians.
Absolutely. I mean, historically, Canada has turned out a few phenoms as far as women's swimming goes. But inevitably, they disappointed at this level. Now this is ancient history, but Elaine Tanner was considered the world's greatest swimmer, greatest women's swimmer back in the late 60s. Nancy Garapek was, again, like, younger than Penny Oleksiak and a dominant figure, but they didn't, for reasons good and bad, achieve at the Olympic level. Elaine Tanner maybe was mismanaged somewhat and was swimming in Mexico City at altitude. It didn't work out, and her career short-circuited. Nancy Garapek was in against East Germany's women swimmers back in 76, and all of them have been implicated in steroid cheating. Penny Oleksiak was able to come in under the radar on this count, and as it stands right now, I think she might become one of the 10 best athletes who ever came out of Monarch Park Secondary School.
right there with Gare Joyce.
There you go. Stan Butler was there too.
Oh, okay. There you go.
And to me, that's one of the reasons why this story is so fantastic, and also why potentially why she's been able to do what she's been able to do. That if you read all the stories this week, it seems as though she wasn't even a star amongst Canada swimming until the Canadian Championships in April, right? So she came out of nowhere to actually make the Olympics. She wasn't really a threat. They were thinking of her towards the 2018 World Championships and maybe 2020. She was going to be seriously contending.
If you lined their swimmers up against the wall and looked at them, though, like she stood out physically as, you know, as
what 16-year-old girl is 6'2"? Like that's, yeah. Like I don't remember any in my high school.
With like lats out to, you know.
Right. She looks the part and you know, from she's such a competitor. Like this, that's what's so amazing to me is nothing of this doesn't feel earned. It's not like she's just a physical specimen and she's just sort of using that, like parlaying that into the success. It seems like from an early age, she was this incredible competitor, even amongst her like siblings. You know, she always wanted to race the older kids and she was always sort of competing with her, her older sister as a collegiate athlete too. Right. So she comes from an athletic family and then amongst them, she was always even, you know, the competitive one kind of thing, which is so great. She's so untouched by all this spotlight. She hasn't had to do these interviews a million times. She's sort of looking with wide eyes around as she's putting up this fantastic, you know, once in a lifetime performance kind of thing. And it just everything about this story seems just fantastic to me right now.
Yeah. And she did it in a, you know, a signature event. Mm-hmm. What the 100 free is the 100 meters on the track. You know, it is, it's a main one. If she had done this in the 200 IM or something like that, or, you know, 200 breast or whatever, it wouldn't really resonate the way that, that this win has.
Mm-hmm. Kind of takes the drama out of a couple of things though now, right? Like what would it take to knock her off the pedestal as the flag bearer for the closing ceremony? Would it take, I mean, even an Andre de Grasse gold medal in the 100 meter. I mean, that's one medal, and we'll get into maybe the difference between the swimming and the athletics, that there's just so many more opportunities to win medals. But I don't know. I can't foresee a situation in which anybody knocks her off her pedestal before the closing ceremony in Rio.
I could see it being a difficult conversation if de Grasse did that, or if de Grasse managed to win gold. Which, I mean, knocking off Usain Bolt would be story of the Olympics.
There'd be a little recency bias there, too, because it'd be the final day of the Games.
For sure. I mean, so, and then you've got the 4x100 as well. So if he could do that as well, if he comes home with two Olympic golds, he becomes this generation's Donovan Bailey. I could see that being it, and especially considering that this is just Penny Oleksiak's first foray into this. They could imagine having her as the, you know, the flag bearer, the next one where she's sort of, you know, favored to win some of these events that she's snuck up on and surprisingly dominated or competed in. So I could see them sort of making this Andre de Grasse's sort of like, yeah, if he gets two golds in those two marquee events, maybe, but I don't see that taking any shine off what Penny and the women's swimming team has done.
Yeah. I mean, the only narrative that I can see with de Grasse winning the 100 is if Usain Bolt beats Usain Bolt and comes up hurt or something like that. And that would take a little bit of the shine off of his accomplishment versus Oleksiak. So, I mean, I think that they can look forward and say, hey, you know, she'll be there 4 years from now. Yep. She can carry it into the stadium at the start rather than the finish. But yeah, she has become the poster girl. There is no doubt about that.
It's amazing how quickly she went from Penny Oleksiak, sister to NHLer Jamie Oleksiak, to Jamie Oleksiak, brother of Olympic hero Penny Oleksiak, right? Like that's now he's in the best hockey league in the world, but yet he is certainly taking a backseat to his 16-year-old sister, I think, for the rest of his NHL career, unless he becomes a Norris candidate.
I mean, it's going to be an interesting story going forward with Penny Oleksiak, though. Is she going to go to the NC2As?
Right.
Or will she go to CIS? If she goes to CIS, her, you know, which is Swim Canada's sort of preferred route, you know, there are a lot more opportunities for her to get some sort of financial reward, and it's a control situation. Like it would be a great win for CIS mm-hmm. if she chooses to go that route.
She'd get a greater sense of competition. I mean, swimming does seem like, you know, you hear Katie Ledecky talk, and she's essentially swimming against herself at this point. She says she's just competing against the time that she wants to hit, and that's her level of success, because the competition just doesn't really factor in, right? And I could see Penny Oleksiak, if she went the CIS route, that would essentially be what she would be doing.
Well, and the other thing is that the NC2A competes in 25-yard and 25-meter pools a lot.
Right.
And you can't even imagine how monotonous that would be for someone like her to train in.
Right.
You know, so it would be a great win for the CIS, not just in swimming, but in sport in general, if an Olympic gold medal winner were to choose to go that route.
Mm-hmm.
So we mentioned Katie Ledecky racing against herself.
Yep.
Michael Phelps quite often is doing that as well, where he's now in his third quadrennial and still getting it done. 26 medals, 22 gold. That's all well and good. Most decorated Olympian of all time. But yeah, there's a lot of swimming races. There's a lot of different opportunities for him to win medals. Usain Bolt doesn't get to run backwards. Not that Michael Phelps competes in the backstroke. But yeah, there's a bunch of different relays, different distances, different strokes. He's great. He's one of the greatest of all time. Mm-hmm. But do we get a little caught up in talking about him being the greatest Olympian of all time?
Yeah, I have talked this one to death. I love swimming. I swim, you know, 4 or 5 times a week. Don't get me wrong, this is no knock on swimming, but just the organization and order of events that are out there. I mean, to have the ability to win three relay medals every in a position like Phelps's, to win three relay medals every Olympics sort of devalues the process. You know, like he can swim 100 leg twice for 2 gold medals. It's like if there were a medley distance relay in track.
Yeah.
And you know, Donovan Bailey could have run 100 twice for 2 gold medals in relays on top of the 100 win. I just hate the fragmentation and of swimming events. Not that swimming is necessarily the worst sport that way, but I just love that the swimmer from Singapore wins the last event.
Right.
Their first individual medal
ever.
Yeah.
A gold medal in any sport.
Yeah.
And you've seen the picture of schooling in Phelps, whatever, 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Where they met.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, I can't even imagine a 50-meter pool fitting in Singapore, right? You know, it's funny because in looking at these Olympics, you know, back in the through the 70s into the 80s, I mean, it was Australia, the Soviet Union, East Germany, and the U.S. in the pool. And that was about it. Canada was at the front of the second rank. And now you have swimmers from all over that are on the podium or at the top of the podium.
Yeah. But I'm going to take the devil's advocate position here, because I feel like over the first week of the Olympics, you know, you start watching a little bit, you know, on the Saturday, Sunday, and then you really start to get into it. And the amount of times that a swimmer like Michael Phelps or Katie Ledecky or whoever can get in the pool, you develop a feel for sort of the packing order and for the rivalries and stuff like that that come out in the personalities. So you actually, by the end of the week, you've got this great sort of knowledge of who you're rooting for and rooting against. And also it feels like that sort of allows the cream to rise to the top, because there's so many events that you wind up with a sense of fairness. Whereas like I was
big
watching
sample size,
right? And you've got like, okay, so ex swimmer, flops in the 200 backstroke. Well, the 100 backstroke is coming up, and then they get a chance to redeem themselves. Or there's that that anchor leg on the 4x100 coming up. They can maybe, you know, do it there. Whereas, yeah, I was watching yesterday's trampoline, and you've got Rosie McLennan winning her second gold medal, and it was fantastic. But she gets to win one medal. She starts in the morning, and she's done mid-afternoon, and that's it. She's done. She works 4 years, and she does that. So it's fantastic. Great for her. But Li Dan, the Chinese trampolinist, she winds up having what looked to me and people watching with me a fantastic run.
I have no idea what the difference was, yeah.
No, I don't know what the difference was. I guess it comes down to the difficulty. Rosie McLennan's routine was just harder. But if I'm Li Dan, I'm thinking, I worked 4 years. I did what I imagined was my best run. I'm dead confused at the score. And that's it. I just kind of have to walk off. But if there was, like, you know, distance trampoline or synchro trampoline or
super
something.
Super trampoline.
Super trampoline coming up.
Bouncier trampoline, yeah.
It's a bouncer trampoline. It's a smaller trampoline. Whatever. It's something. Like, you get more than one kick at the cat to say, look, like, I feel like I'm the best here. I got a surprise bronze. I don't know why. Or the person who came fourth. It's like, that wasn't my best showing. I want another chance to beat Rosie the Golden Girl, right? Like, in swimming, there are all those other chances, and it's great for that.
Well, if you're saying that the cream rises to the top in the pool, I think it might be the algae that's rising to the top in the pool. I mean,
yeah,
that's a diving pool.
That is pretty unseemly. It's like Brazilian St. Patrick's Day or something like that.
Well, let's go down that route because the major talking point for people who were not that familiar with some of the athletes going into these Rio games was, was it going to be an abject disaster? Like it is before every Olympics, seemingly.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't matter. Summer, winter, everything's going to be a disaster. Rarely is it. Maybe never. We heard the same things about Sochi, and things generally went off without a hitch. There have been a few things, right? And if you're one of those members of the media that was in a bus that was shot at, like you
probably Trump supporters that were...
You probably don't feel like you're probably not answering this question the same way. You probably think there are massive problems.
Mm-hmm.
But if your biggest problem is a little too much algae in the diving pool and it smells like a fart, which apparently it does, I guess there's worse things.
Problem. That's a pretty big problem,
though. I suppose.
And, you know, like there's some divers who've been sort of saying that they feel like they've gotten some in their eyes and stuff like that. So we'll see. Maybe it plays out.
We haven't seen the
bit.
Open water swimming yet either.
No. That's going to be an event on Fear Factor.
Yeah.
You know, the winner will test negative for steroids, but positive for E. coli.
And you'll be pushing limbs out of your way.
That's right.
Yeah, that'd be great.
But they've got to get back in that diving pool. They've closed it. And now they have to get back into that thing. Are they going to suddenly fix the water? Because like Tom Daley of Britain is, you know, expressing his concern. He's like, I don't want to get back in that water. I don't think he said that exactly, but you know, it's close too. So are they just going to move it? Okay, everybody, we're flying you to Houston. You know, like, I don't know.
This there is a certain cringe factor to this whole conversation. I have to say, you know, but in terms of like things that have not measured up, I have to say, looking at Olympic golf, this is not the greatest introduction they could have had. If Olympic golf had started in 96 and they're playing at Augusta.
Yeah, which apparently they were very close to doing.
Yeah, and there was a lot of connection between Augusta National's executive board and Billy Payne with the Atlanta Olympics. But boy, it's a pretty sad looking event. It looks like you're tuning into Golf Channel in January saying like, this is the best course in Hawaii.
Yeah.
You know, like there's a smattering of fans out there. I think they're going to have to do a real rethink on this, especially with the games going.
It didn't help that a lot of the best golfers in the world backed out.
But even if they were there, the look of it just sucks.
It just feels like another tournament, but not even that.
Not even.
And maybe it will feel differently, I'm sure, if Graham Dillette has a great weekend and he wins gold, but...
Well, to us, yes. To the world, no, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if they'd done this in London, 4 years ago, and they're playing at the Belfry or something like that, doesn't have to be one of the British Open courses. But there would be a quality of course available to the Olympics that there just isn't in Rio.
Right. And I mean, yeah, so we're talking about, yeah, like you said, if Graham Dillette or David Hearn or someone like that have a great weekend and we wind up winning gold, silver, I'll feel great about golf at the Olympics right now. Just like I'm feeling great about swimming. I want more swimming events. Let's do them all just because of I want to see more Penny Oleksiak and more interviews with her and the other women who are dominating.
Well, and the guy who wins the Olympics, and I guess the Australian golfer's out in front first, but
yeah, but Fraser.
Yeah. I mean, would he have been on the Olympic team if the other guys are going?
Certainly not.
No. So, I mean, that's going to be a story unto itself and sort of like dilutes, you know, the win in terms of the public opinion.
It's Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network, Ben Ennis, Garrett Joyce, Craig Battle. So there's still some medals to be won in team sports, specifically women's soccer, where Team Canada is through to the semifinals with a win over France. But there will be no rematch against the Americans, who were dumped by Sweden in the quarters. 1-1 game went to kicks, and Hope Solo dove the wrong way. And then post-match had a fun little quote in which she called the Swedes cowards for the way they played that game. They played in a defensive shell. They parked the bus, if you're familiar with soccer parlance, in that they didn't go forward. They didn't try to score more goals. They tried to limit the opposition's opportunities to score, which is a very common strategy, especially when you believe you are outskilled. You have less talent than the other team. It's not like the first time it's ever happened in the history of soccer. We want to talk about Alex Rodriguez being a guy you love to hate, love to root against. Boy, Hope Solo is that and more, seemingly, when it comes to the American soccer team.
Yeah, I think Donald Trump is going to name her the Secretary of Sport.
Yeah,
right. Then pay her 70% of what other cabinet members are making. But, you know what? It's completely in keeping with the established Hope Solo expectations. You know, I mean, damage control or whatever. Back when the U.S. was beating Canada in London, and like, you know, thanks to like a really dubious, virtually unprecedented on-field ruling. You know, she's willing to overlook the good breaks that the U.S. has got over the years. But, she is pretty hard to take.
Right, and when she changed the gloves to try to ice the final.
I didn't mind that, actually.
I thought that was a little cheesy, especially at that level.
No, that was.
Yeah, I mean, like, sure, it's strategy. But then if you sort of take it from that kind of point of view that, you know, her strategy is somehow not cowardly or not untoward, but
right.
Like protecting the ball is this horrible thing that, you know, is beneath the level of competition.
Yeah. And the gloves, you know, the look, right.
Yeah.
I mean, they look like hockey gloves or something
sure.
like that. It was a strange moment,
yeah.
But like it, you're asking for it. I've always thought like, the big costume change or something like that is like it's a curse in sports, right? Do you remember when Federer came out in that weird looking top in London, at Wimbledon, and that's where the first time he goes down there,
right?
But as soon as you start mucking with the formula like that, good
right.
night.
And when she's looking in her gloves, like there's, you know, how did I get all these pebbles in here? You know, sort of like what's wrong with my hands? Like, she's, oh geez, pain, so much pain. These gloves are killing me. You know, sort of like the it's a reason the Raptors fans still hate Paul Pierce. You know, or like, you know, sort of like the acting and like the, oh geez, I've never.
Oh, you think showing up in a wheelchair is yeah, it's a
sure.
little over the top.
Yeah, it's like I'm not going to be able to do this. Oh, my hands are it's a glove thing. I've got to get new gloves, and she throws them on the ground in front of the equipment trainer. It's just like it didn't show well for her. Like it didn't make her look, you know, like a very classy competitor. And then all of a sudden she piles on.
She would be great in the WWE.
Oh yeah.
That is like a career move for her.
Oh, totally.
Yeah. There's no need to turn heel. Like she's never been a face.
No. But you know, those gloves made her look like Justin Timberlake in Saturday Night Live. You know, that character
oh, sure.
with
yeah,
the,
yeah. yeah.
Right down to Omaville. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah. I mean, Hope Solo, unfortunately, isn't going to go away, even if she's played her last game in the Olympics or world competition. Guaranteed, she will not go away.
Right, and I mean, for the Canadian fan watching that, who remembers that semifinal against the States, that was a pretty semi satisfying moment. You don't want to see any team go out like that. The shootout is generally not a great judge of.
This is my favorite shootout of all time.
Oh, it was great. Yeah. Like, I feel like that was a for a random outcome, even though, the U.S. was probably the better team. You know, you play that game again, the U.S. probably wins it, being a little choked up for the fact that, you really felt like you deserved that game. You know, obviously, you can say, you know what, we feel like the better team lost, but, good on them. They got the shootout, moving on. It's you don't have to take it to such a crazy, unclassy, negative place, but I guess that's just sort of the way that she plays things.
You have to if you're Hope Solo.
Yeah,
you're, right. You're like you would have disappointed the Hope Soloists out there.
That's great.
That's good. I like that. Coming up, it's almost hockey season, but for many, especially if you're into a junior hockey the way Gare Joyce is, it's already begun. It never ends, really. It just rolls along. It just overlaps into itself. We got the World Cup upcoming, and then start of the NHL season, but the U18s, if from this country, a bit of a tough go of it in Plymouth, and then at the Ivan Hlinka Memorial Tournament, we'll talk about their disappointments. Also, Masai Ujiri potentially, according to reports, on the verge of a contract extension with the Toronto Raptors. That and more coming up next. Ben Annis, Gare Joyce, Craig Battle at Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
With a taste of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet Magazine, here's Gare Joyce.
Nobody roots for Goliath. That's what Wilt Chamberlain said back in the day. Nobody wants to see the big guy win. Back in the 90s, Eric Lindros was the National Hockey League's big guy. He was Goliath on ice.
Basket of boards and blast by Eric Lindros, and that brings quite a reaction. In front, Shannon hit across, the Lindros score!
All right, the fans here love this one. Who was the big guy on this goal? That man right there, Lindros. Oh, baby. Is this Lindros hockey or what?
I covered a lot of hockey back in the 90s. For 3 years in the middle of the decade, Lindros may have been the game's best player. No doubt he was the most feared. Lindros's career spiraled downward from 99 on. Concussions did him in. Awful stuff. Borderline criminal hits like the one Scott Stevens laid on him. Lindros was done at age 35. Nobody cried for Goliath then, and nobody voted to put Goliath in the Hockey Hall of Fame either. He was passed over 5 times. Then this summer, the hall called. With Lindros set for induction with hockey's greats, I look back on the career of the scariest player I've ever seen. I also talked to him about his support of concussion research and his work on public awareness about head injuries. If you found it hard to like Eric Lindros as a player, you can't help but root for him now.
Story and more can be found in the latest issue of Sportsnet Magazine. Available on texture by next issue or by downloading the Sportsnet Magazine app for Apple, Android, and Windows tablets and phones. This ain't like when you're at a game and sign up for a credit card just to get the prize and then you immediately cancel the credit card. Because there's no prize when you sign up for our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network, Ben Annis, Craig Battle, and Gare Joyce. It's all about baseball. It's all about the Olympics right now in August. But soon you'll be thinking about hockey. Maybe you already are. Canada's under-20 team playing some games in Plymouth. That didn't go so well. And a junior's flaming out in the Ivan Hlinka Memorial Tournament. Gare Joyce is going to tell us why we should be freaking out Or are you going to talk us off the ledge here, Gare? What should we be doing? Tell us what
to
do.
I'm going to talk you onto the ledge.
Okay, great.
No, I mean, it's been a really, really rotten summer for Hockey Canada, for Canadian age group hockey. The U20 team was très ordinaire in Plymouth, losing all three games, Finland, Sweden, and the U.S. A disappointment there. And despite the presence of the Stroms, the Mariners, and I mean, they had their elite to pick from, not that they all played in every game, but it was not a shining moment. I know it's summer hockey, but still, you know, it's a key for evaluation for who's going to go to the World Junior Championship that's going to be played in Toronto and Montreal this holiday season. You know, at the same time, and looking at the bigger picture, I mean, that's just like one summer tournament. But we have to remember, despite winning the gold in 2015, and that one by the narrowest of margins with Connor McDavid, one goal in a final on home ice. You know, the Canadian World Junior team's gone medalless in three of the last four World Junior Championships. And based on what you saw in Plymouth and based on, you know, conversations that I had with scouts who've been there, there's not a lot of promise of them, you know, coming through, winning gold, or maybe even getting on the podium in this upcoming tournament. At the same time, or slightly after, the Ivan Holinka Summer Under 18s is being played. Canada beat Finland for fifth place. The U.S. team is playing in the gold medal game today, Saturday, and you know, which wouldn't be remarkable on its face. But the U.S. sends its B team to the Ivan Holinka. That is, none of the players that are on the USDT, their development team in Plymouth, go to the Ivan Holinka. So, in fact, the U.S. team that'll go to the under 18 championships in this coming spring will be made up of players across the board who are an upgrade from the team that's playing for the championship at the Ivan Holinka. And like the optics just couldn't be worse for Hockey Canada.
So what do we do? Do we need to have a summit? Can you put your finger on it? Is this just a bad time for Canada's developmental program? It seems like we've got plenty of young Canadian stars in the National Hockey League, and maybe that's the problem. We got too many 18-year-olds in the NHL right now.
And I looked back at the 2016 draft, and nine of the top 21 kids were Canadian, even though they didn't have more than two.
Yeah, but one of the top nine.
Right, yeah, one of the top nine, two
in
the top 10.
You have to count down to find that. So, I think there has to be a fundamental rethink on, on our approach, on Canada's approach to these tournaments. You know, it seems like the Finns have it figured out. You know, their record at all levels of this tournament, you know, winning both U18 and 20 this past season, and just their record in recent years, it's much better than Canada's. And it would look like they have fewer resources to work with, and yet they get these outsized performances. You know, for years, nations, their hockey federations would come to study Hockey Canada's approach to youth development hockey. I think it's high time that Hockey Canada sort of took a hard look at what other programs are doing. I think, like, it would be not the worst time in the world for something of a house cleaning at Hockey Canada. I think it's grown stale, and you know, they can wave the flag and talk about the glory days, but one World Junior gold since 2009, largely on the back of the best class that they've had in Connor McDavid and Domi and Reinhardt. They had a lot of talent on that team. You know, that to me, that tournament was an outlier. You know, I think a new approach is in order. And if Canada does not get on the podium in this upcoming World Junior, I think there has to be, there will be a lot of self-examination and government white papers, whatever, you know, but it's going to come.
But to me, the ultimate guideline or, you know, sort of measuring stick for hockey success is sort of that senior team best on best. Does this sort of play into that? Are we looking at a situation where 5-6 years down the road, when Connor McDavid is in his prime, he's not going to have the type of support he needs to win at that level? And then, you know, sort of we're going to see senior team results like we're seeing with the World Juniors now?
Yeah, well, I mean, when Connor McDavid's 28, what's he going to look back on, you know, as players coming from behind and pressing him or approaching him or just, you know, supporting and surrounding him? You know, I think it does become an issue after a while. You know, this last draft class with one Canadian in the top nine prospects in the draft, I think is pretty representative. You know, I think you take a look at Patrick Laine, right? He'll probably have more surrounding talent when he's 28 than Connor McDavid will, the way things are going right now.
Yeah, and now you got Penny Oleksiak and all these young Canadians want to be swimmers instead of hockey players. So it's not helping all the success we're having in the pool at the Olympics either.
Well, if they can get Penny Oleksiak playing for Canada, I'm all for it. You know? Yeah. But in fact, I don't know that there's much danger that her brother's going to be playing for Canada.
That's true as well. He'll be the lesser known Oleksiak, already is, seemingly.
It'd be a great match race, right? It would, but anyways.
Right.
Putting it out there for programmers.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Ben Ennis, Gare Joyce, Craig Battle. Also this week, and this shouldn't be a surprise because he's done such a great job and seemingly there's been no missteps yet in one of the most universally beloved executives in the history of Toronto sports, Masai Ujiri, apparently on the verge of a contract extension. Maybe we see a situation, Craig, and there's not a lot to go on as far as this type of an executive in the city of Toronto, where a guy is here for decades and decades and sees a bunch of different generations of team and franchise that he's overseeing. Maybe we could be seeing that with Masai Ujiri. Again, we're talking about, I guess, a relatively small sample size of him and his return to Toronto as the general manager. But yeah, he is, there's not a lot of dissenters on the from the Church of Masai.
No, I don't think there are. I think you can quibble with certain elements. You can quibble with his draft records. The re-upping of Terrence Ross at the time looked like he might have jumped the gun.
Bruno Caboclo,
in terms of that draft record, DeAndre Daniels later on in that draft. There's a couple of guys who it seems like we've whiffed on. But then again, when you look at it, you're like, well, Norman Powell was a 40-something pick, right? And he winds up looking like a potential you know, either a major piece for them or a potential trade piece that they can, because they're kind of loaded at two guard right now. So yeah, that's something where it's like you got essentially a first round talent for, you know, nothing at the tail end of a draft. And that was, it came back in a Grievous Vasquez trade. So you turned Grievous Vasquez into Norman Powell, which is fantastic. There's nobody who's going to quibble with that. So I think what you've gotten, Masai, is sort of a baseline comfort that he's not shooting from the hip. He's not trying any flavor of the month strategy style. He's going to make sound decisions. He's going to make them, he's going to think them through. He's got a good team around him. And you've got a situation where, yeah, like you might not be competing for the title right now, given the small amount of teams that tend to have that shot heading into a season, but you know, you're going to have a competitive team. You know, you're going to have, a sound decision maker. And if there is an opportunity, he's going to probably jump on it, you know, that he's making the calls. He has goodwill around the league. He's got fantastic reputation, good contacts, that moving to another GM who's a flavor of the month type isn't going to improve you any. You know, like if the decision comes that you need to sort of make a rebuild, then Masai is the one to do that for you, right? It's not like, oh, get some new guy who needs to bring his own team in and develop relationships and all that sort of thing.
But if they ever got to a situation where they had to rebuild, the conversation surrounding Masai Ujiri might be a little different at that point as well.
But, I mean, it might. You've got, like, when that time comes, you're going to wind up with a situation where it's either injuries or a player moving on, you know, in a Kyle Lowry, you know, bouncing next summer where you've given him every opportunity. And Masai Ujiri and Dwayne Casey are co-credited with helping Kyle Lowry become the player that he is now. He inherited DeMar DeRozan, but that's sort of a lot of those guys' development and sort of comfort level with the team. And, you know, you look at DeMar DeRozan's deal this summer, he didn't take another meeting with another team. That's a compliment to Masai Ujiri. So, yeah, like you say, if they're suddenly a bottoming out team, then you're going to have to question whatever move Masai did or didn't make to precipitate that. But I feel like there's a lot that's not in a GM's hands, and I feel like a lot of it would probably be in that realm because he's a sound decision maker and he knows what he's doing.
Yeah, I mean, you look at it, there was some hand-wringing, some distress about losing Bismack in the offseason, but the real lesson that you can take from that is that, you know, Masai was able to identify a talent in the wilderness, you know, like when it came to re-signing Bismack, like at the terms he got, I don't know that they could possibly go there. But the fact is they remembered where they found him. They can just, there'll be more guys like him, you know, in that bracket, you know? And so, I mean, give Masai credit for finding a guy like Biyombo who is like a useful part in last spring.
Yeah, and now they're doing a similar deal with Jared Solinger where they've identified a guy who wasn't going to get a long-term contract, who was waived after a lot of the big money had already gone out. That guy wasn't signing for a bunch of years because he's looking for another opportunity to get a payday. So they jumped on him. They gave him $6 million. They said, we're going to give you an opportunity to show what you can do. And then that's where they took it. So he's able to jump on those opportunities, and he got a starting caliber power forward for $6 million, which you can, you know, oh, geez, you would have really liked to have 4 or 5 years.
A motivated guy, too, in a contract year.
A motivated guy in a contract year. They identified that opportunity. They saw it coming. They didn't, you know, they would have had to trade off a bunch of salary to overpay anybody. They didn't have an opportunity at Bismack with the cap situation that they have. But I don't think they wanted to anyway. Like you said, Gary, like at a $3 million, they identified a guy who was a major difference maker for them in the playoffs, and they got a really nice payback. But whether Bismack Biyombo was the guy to do that, to pay off at $15 million a year over a number of years, I don't think that's the case. And I think Masai saw that coming. You know, we're not going to pay this guy.
Yeah, we always talk about GMs, and no matter what the sport, talk about their record in the draft, and you know that's supposed to be the measure in a lot of ways of managerial success. You know, trades would be up there as well, but identifying the guy who is an established pro, although maybe not playing to his potential, or someone who you know can grow at a stage where you think he's sort of a locked in value, you know, I mean, that is really, when you have a GM that does that, I mean, you can go a long way.
Yeah. Good times in Raptor land. That'll do it for Sportsnet Magazine Live. For Gare Joyce, Craig Battle, I'm Ben Ennis. This is the Sportsnet Radio Network.